By degrees, I hope to induce the return of thousands of our brethren to the land of Israel. I am sure they would be happy in the enjoyment of the observance of our holy religion in a manner which is impossible in Europe. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 149, Victorians and Jerusalem. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. If there is a moment that captures, in the Victorian era, the fearless projection of British power in the name of equality and liberty, it was perhaps the episode known as the Don Pacifico Affair. In 1850, a mob in Athens destroyed the property of a Sephardic Jew from Gibraltar named Don Pacifico. Pacifico, due to his birth on that island, had the status of a British subject, and the foreign secretary of the Whig government in London, John Henry Temple, known most famously as Lord Palmerston, ordered the British fleet to blockade Athens in order to seek restitution for Pacifico. This was widely denounced as a gross overreaction, and many of Palmerston's enemies incorrectly anticipated that this would spell his political downfall. In a long speech in Parliament, Palmerston made reference to the fact that claiming Roman citizenship was once a source of protection within that ancient empire, and he saw his duty as seeking to protect British subjects around the world without fear. Palmerston concluded, quote, "I therefore fearlessly challenge the verdict which this House, as representing a political, a commercial, a constitutional country, is to give on the question now brought before it, whether the principles on which the foreign policy of Her Majesty's government has been conducted, and the sense of duty which has led us to think ourselves bound to afford protection to our fellow subjects abroad, are proper and fitting guides for those who are charged with the government of England, and whether, as the Roman in days of old held himself free from indignity when he could say civis Romanus sum, so also a British subject, in whatever land he may be, shall feel confident that the watchful eye and the strong arm of England will protect him against injustice and wrong." End quote. Palmerston embodied the belief that Britain represented liberty. He once was famously told by someone from France something like, "If I were not a Frenchman, I would want to be an Englishman," to which he in turn replied something like, "If I were not an Englishman, I would like to be an Englishman." And two other individuals in this era, one related to Palmerston, would themselves devise international and foreign policy plans concerning the state of the Jews on the other side of the world, reflecting, each in their own way, a future of British involvement in Jerusalem. The 1830s were a time of turbulence and change for Jerusalem and the Holy Land. Since the exit of France from Egypt in the early 19th century, power had been wielded there by the Albanian Mehmed Ali, who, though technically under the Sultan's rule, exerted profound power over that country and, in the 1830s, extended his power into the region known as Syria, including the Holy Land. It was during this period, especially after a terrible earthquake in Safed in 1837, that more Jews poured into Jerusalem. This was also a period of activity by two British subjects deeply interested in the Holy Land, each motivated by their respective faith. One was Lord Ashley, the Earl of Shaftesbury, married to the stepdaughter of Lord Palmerston. As described in Gertrude Himmelfarb's fascinating book about Philo-Semitism in England, Shaftesbury was very interested in two things: the conversion of the Jews, an endeavor in which he had little success, and in the restoration of the Jews to the Holy Land. Himmelfarb writes, quote, "Because of his family connections, Ashley played a major role in encouraging Britain's involvement in Palestine. It was he who convinced Palmerston in 1838 to include in a commercial treaty a provision for the appointment of a British consul to Jerusalem, one of whose functions was to protect the lives and property of Jewish settlers. It was a vice consul, not a consul, who was appointed, but Britain was the first power to have a consul of any rank in Jerusalem." Ashley was exultant. For him, although not Palmerston, this was the first step in the ultimate goal, the restoration of Jews. End quote. Himmelfarb gives us selections from the Earl of Shaftesbury's jubilant reflections on the appointment of this consul. Shaftesbury wrote, "What a wonderful event it is! The ancient city of the people of God is about to resume a place among the nations, and England is the first of the Gentile kingdoms that ceases to trod her down." And Shaftesbury added, "I shall always remember that God put it into my heart to conceive the plan for his honor, gave me influence to prevail with Palmerston, and provided a man for the situation who can remake Jerusalem in his mirth." End quote. Himmelfarb further describes a memo written by Shaftesbury in 1840 for the foreign secretary for Palmerston, arguing that Britain should seek Jewish restoration in the Holy Land. Though Shaftesbury did not achieve this goal, the words of the Earl given us by Himmelfarb are worth reading, and it is also worth bearing them in mind for our future discussion of the Balfour Declaration. Describing why the Jews could bring an era of flourishing to the Holy Land, Shaftesbury wrote, quote, "There are many reasons why more is to be anticipated from them than from any others who might settle there. They have ancient reminiscences and deep affection for the land. It is connected in their hearts with all that is bright in their past and with all that is right in those which are to come. Their industry and perseverance are prodigious. They subsist and cheerfully on the smallest pittance." And Shaftesbury added, "Long ages of suffering have trained their people to habits of endurance and self-denial. They would joyfully exhibit them in the settlement and service of their ancient country." End quote. So Shaftesbury wrote. Meanwhile, another prominent Victorian, one whom we have recently met, arrived again in Jerusalem. This was Moses Montefiore, who returned with his wife Judith in the 1830s. He came to a Holy Land whose Jewish population had been transformed over the past three decades. As Green tells us, quote, "The Jewish population there had doubled since 1800, escalating in the 1830s to a peak of nearly 10,000 before the disastrous earthquake of 1837. Even at the best of times, nearly half the community died every 10 years. This state of affairs gave immigration real impact. In 1800, Green continues, only 5% of Jews in Palestine were Ashkenazim. By 1839, they represented over 30% of the Jewish population." End quote. And Simon Montefiore, in his book on Jerusalem, points out that by 1840, the Jews were 5,000 out of the 15,000 of the population in Jerusalem. As Green further describes, with the increase in Jerusalem of diverse Jewish groups, tension also grew between them. And Moses Montefiore, arriving in Jerusalem in the late 1830s, dedicated himself to attempting to resolve these differences, thereby reflecting a deep understanding of a theme that we have emphasized throughout this series, that Jerusalem is meant to embody the ideal of unity of the chosen people. But aside from Montefiore's mediation and the philanthropic support that he extended to the Jewish community, his mind began to ponder the larger possibilities of a Jewish future in the Holy Land. And his recorded reflections are, with the hindsight of history, absolutely incredible. Montefiore wrote, quote, "From all information I have been able to gather, the land in this neighborhood appears to be particularly favorable for agricultural speculation. There are groves of olive trees, I should think, more than 500 years old, vineyards, much pasture, plenty of wells, and abundance of excellent water. Also fig trees, walnuts, almonds, mulberries, etc., and rich fields of wheat, barley, and lentils. In fact, it is a land that would produce almost everything in abundance with very little skill and labor. I am sure if the plan I have in contemplation should succeed, it will be the means of introducing happiness and plenty into the Holy Land. In the first instance, I shall apply to Muhammad Ali for a grant of land for 50 years, some 100 or 200 villages, giving him an increased rent of from 10% to 20%, and paying the whole in money annually at Alexandria, but the land and villages to be free during the whole term from every tax or rate." End quote. Thus did Montefiore conceive of the idea of negotiating with the ruler of Egypt, and at that moment the Holy Land, for a future of Jewish cultivation of the land of their ancestors. Montefiore a bit later added, quote, "This grant obtained, I shall please heaven on my return to England, form a company for the cultivation of the land and the encouragement of our brethren in Europe to return to Palestine. Many Jews now emigrate to New South Wales, Canada, etc., but in the Holy Land they would find a greater certainty of success. Here they will find wells already dug, olives and vines already planted, and a land so rich as to require little manure. By degrees I hope to induce the return of thousands of our brethren to the land of Israel. I am sure they would be happy in the enjoyment of the observance of our holy religion in a manner which is impossible in Europe." End quote. As Green points out, Montefiore here was not focusing on political Zionism or national independence. He was pondering the development of the land, but his words are still, I believe, quite wondrous. Remember the promise of Judah Halevi, the poetic giant of southern Spain, at the end of his work, The Kuzari. He wrote, "Jerusalem can only be rebuilt when Israel yearns for it to such an extent that they embrace her stones and dust." Those are Halevi's words. And Nachmanides, the rabbinic giant of northern Spain, as we have also seen, had insisted that the land was waiting for the Jewish people's return, and then it would fully blossom. Now Montefiore, heir to a community that looked to these two men, a member of the Sephardic community of England, pondered Jews cherishing the land of Israel and cultivating the land. Montefiore's reflection presaged his further involvement in the Holy Land, its development, and, of course, in the future, the land itself would bear fruit, literally and figuratively, in vindication of all Moses Montefiore believed about what could occur in that sacred place. Montefiore soon set back to England, not knowing that he would be returning to the Middle East very soon. It would be a crisis that would bring him back there, one we shall tell tomorrow, when we shall see that, as with other famous subjects of Britain, it would be a crisis in which this statesman, Moses Montefiore, would make manifest his finest hour. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.